And she said, I want a divorce. And I like paused and thought about it. It's like, okay, that's okay. I said, why? That's all I said. I said, why? She said, I'm in love with someone else. I said, who? And she said the guy's name, who had been our neighbor for like 7 years up until recently.
Welcome to Aggressive Life, Harrison Scott Key. Some people just have these names that, like, why don't I have that name? What a good, Harrison Scott Key. He is a funny man whose life has taken some less than funny turns. He had a devastating turn, which I thought about maybe just having him talk. We will have him talk about it, but I'll just let the cat out of the bag. His devastating turn, discovering that his wife and the mother of his three daughters was having an affair with a family friend. How does a humor writer respond to that? Well, by writing with hilarious and sometimes heartbreaking insight into the nature of relationships. Relationships is something everyone wants, but very few people want to do. Having a relationship and doing a relationship are completely different things. Spoiler alert, Harrison and his wife, Lauren, are still married. In fact, she even writes a chapter from her perspective in the new memoir, How to Stay Married, the most insane love story ever. We had guests on a couple weeks ago. We were talking about how anecdotally it seems like the people we interact with, there's more women that are having affairs than men. Here's another one. What is the reason of this? What's the cause of this? I don't know, and we're not going to be able to solve that, but we are going to be able to get into one person's story of how he decided to make an aggressive move with forgiveness. Yeah, aggressive things is not always sort of manly machismo, over-the-top physical feats or bold things that maybe someone will write a movie about you. It's doing bold things that are close to God's heart and are very, very, very hard, like forgiveness. So we're going to hear his unbelievable story today on The Aggressive Life, Harrison Scott Key.
I feel like I need like tom-toms and like strobe lights and all that.
Now. So you've got the writers, you have the writer's name. When did writing become a thing for you where you said, oh, I'm gonna actually make a living at this?
Well, that came later. I've been writing all my life. It was just a really natural way for me to express myself. I was writing, you know, I was the kid in elementary school passing notes. I wrote love letters to everyone. I typed my first, like, I used my typewriter the first time, I think, when I was about 11 years old. And I also wrote love letters on that. And then all through school growing up, I wrote letters to people. I wrote letters to my family when I was in college. I had pen pals growing up. I wrote letters. I still have letters that I wrote to my grandparents, and they wrote me back. And so writing was just such a natural way of being and understanding the world. And then I majored in psychology and philosophy and didn't really consider myself a writer, although I was writing for the school paper in college. And then I went to grad school for acting and was really not great at acting. I don't know how I got into grad school, but I started writing my own material for auditions, writing my own monologues, and that's how I got into it. And sometime around age 25 or so, I decided I would make a living as a writer. I didn't want to be a journalist, but I loved writing, especially writing for performance, so like speech writing. So mm-hmm. I was a speech writer for a long time. I just love writing, and it's just something I'll do until I die or can no longer type on a keyboard.
Writing's a tough gig, maybe not the speechwriter aspect, but dealing with publishers and manuscripts and deadlines and long, 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 long timelines and publishing houses who have skeletal staff and many of them minimal drive, it can be really, that's a tough gig, man. Are you liking what you're doing?
Sure, man. I mean, all different, types of work have their annoyances. I'm pretty used to how publishing works now. It can be slow. It's really slow. And then all of a sudden there's parts of publishing that move really fast. But that's not really why you do or don't do a thing. It's the sitting at the table at the desk in my lawn chair in my yard at the keyboard or with a pen like that. That's just there's nothing gets better than that for me, even when I'm stuck. And, I'm not writing. I didn't go into writing so I could work with publishers, although that's cool and really awesome and a necessary part of it. It's just the act of writing itself, which is so appealing and enjoyable and can make writer's block really frustrating because the writing process itself is so exhilarating for me. I mean, I love it. It's just, I took my computer, I went to the doctor this morning for a, annual checkup. And I knew I would only wait 5 minutes, but I took my laptop in so I could get a few more ideas down. It's exciting. Yeah. I just love seeing what I'm going to find out when I open a document.
That's cool. Well, that means you're in the right line of work.
Yeah, I think so, for better and worse.
So your book the title is just so intriguing, How to Stay Married. How to Stay Married. Tell me why you started to write this book. When did the dream or the vision for the book start to take shape?
Well, I don't really know the answer to that question because, I just have always written about my life or written about the world from my perspective forever. And, this is my third book. So I'd written two, I guess you would call them memoirs. In 2015, my first book came out, The World's Largest Man. And then in 2018, my second book, Congratulations, Who Are You Again, came out. And so in the midst of living through the events I describe in this book, the events in my marriage and in my family, which really happened, the main part of the action happens between 2017 and 2021. And in the midst of it, I was writing a book, a different book that I never finished. And I was sort of writing about religion and sort of my experiences with God and with the church and with religion. It was a funny book and sort of essays kind of. But all this stuff started going down, and I just knew that it wasn't like, oh, I should write about this. I don't really, when you write like I do, when you write constantly every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. and I just write.
Wow.
So there wasn't a moment where I was like, oh, I should write about this. This was happening to me. And so that's what I did is I wrote. And in the midst of these events, this was in 2020 now, when things really hit the fan, my therapist was like, oh, you should try journaling. And I'm like, have you not been listening? Like, I'm a writer. That's what I do. That's all I do is write. And she was like, well, that's great. You should journal about all these feelings you're feeling right now. And so I started writing, and I hate journaling because there's no audience for that. It's just, I don't even think God reads people's journals. Like, it's that boring. And so I started writing letters to my wife, and we were then separated. And of course, they were very maudlin and emotional, and I was, kind of hurt and broken. And so I started kind of writing funny letters to my wife about all the stuff that was going on because we're separated and she was living just down the street, but it felt like she was living on the other side of the planet. And I just realized, like, I think this is a book. Now, you ask that question, why would I write this? Because it's such a revealing book and it involves this whole other person, my wife. Who in their right mind would ever want their spouse to write a book like this? when you've had an affair and then, you know, and it turns out that your spouse is a writer, like that's kind of bad news for you. and I told my agent before I told my wife, I said,
hold on, Harrison, are you sending her these letters at this point?
No.
Okay. Got it.
No. Yeah. Good question. These were kind of therapeutic. I thought if we ever reconcile, I'll give these letters to her. I thought at first I would, but that sort of was violating the principle of the separation. I mean, we needed, you know, in an ideal world, when you separate, you're not separating just as a prelude to divorce. You're separating. I mean, the laws are different in every state, but a separation is sort of the law's way of saying, make sure you want to do this. Like, there might be some problems you can solve with each other just by living apart for a time. And that's sort of how I went into it. That's how she said that's how she was going into it. But I think maybe she thought like, well, we'll get a divorce after this. Like, it's fine. Like, she was ready. She was ready to leave the marriage. And so I wasn't going to send her any of these letters. She and I both needed to deal with our own stuff. And we both were in agreement that we both had really big issues that needed to be dealt with. And this is not a spoiler, this is all in the book. When we begin to reconcile for the third or fourth time, and it seems like it's going to stick, like we're really going to try and make it work, we were really at rock bottom. She'd been home for a few weeks, and I was like, and we were talking every day. I mean, we were in therapy together once a week, and then we each had our own therapist separately that we also went to once a week. So that's a lot of therapy for two people. And we were talking like every morning. I mean, you know, everything was raw and everything was exposed. It was total transparency. And every morning the girls, we have three daughters, they would go to school and Lauren and I would sit on my tailgate in our driveway because I was writing outside a lot in those days. And she'd come outside and we'd have a cigarette. Cigarettes were very therapeutic and important. If
Amen.
Anybody listening,
Amen, hallelujah.
If Amen, anybody's hallelujah. Ever listening who's had a cigarette, they're just so perfect for talking with another person. Hmm. They create the perfect space for it. So we're sitting there smoking, you know, and in the morning, and we would just talk. And she could ask me anything, and I could ask her anything. It was totally transparent because of all the sort of hell that we had gone through together. And I just told her one day, I was like, you know, I think I'm going to write this in a book. And I knew she wouldn't like it. I knew she wouldn't want that. And it took some time. The first thing she said was like, can't you write a book about the dog? Like, people love books about dogs. Like, we would be millionaires. And I was like, it's fine. You're right. It's too soon. She was like, why would you write it so soon? You know, whatever. She just didn't think it was worthwhile. She didn't think anybody would care to read this story. And we were still healing, obviously, still very tender.
Yeah, you said You said this is the third or fourth time you tried to reconcile. What do you mean by that?
Well, this was our first separation, but it wasn't the first instance of this particular affair. Oh, okay. And you have to read the book sort of to know what I'm saying by that. But people who've read it will get what I mean. It had just been really, tumultuous few years for us. And it's complicated. Why would we stay married after all this stuff? And that's why I wrote the book, right? You just have to read that. And you can ask me some questions about it. But to make a long story short, I knew that I was going to have to write just so I could understand what happened. I had to express the story in language just to even fully get my head around what happened. And she and I were both talking to friends about all this, and we were in therapy, and she had her small group of friends, and I had my small group of friends. Then we had some friends in common, and we're talking about all this stuff. So for a year, I wrote and I wrote and I wrote, and it came out so fast. And it was almost like war reporting because a lot of the events had just happened. And when something has just happened, maybe your perspective is off a little bit because you haven't had time to really process. But one thing that's great about writing so soon after an event is that you just remember so many vivid details. And kind of like, like in Vietnam, you know, the Rolling Stone sent some really crazy, awesome reporters to Vietnam to write about the war. And they were sending these crazy stories back home. One of those stories actually became a book that became Apocalypse Now. It was all very, like, war reporting is very sort of immediate. And that's what I felt like the book was. And so a year, just over a year after she had come home and we were clearly reconciled and still tender, but we felt like our marriage was going to work this time. And we both seemed to be committed to it. I handed her the book and I was like, hey, remember a year ago when I told you I was going to write a book and you said no. And I said, okay, well, I wrote it. And if you hate it, nobody will ever see it. Like, I'll burn it tomorrow. And I gave it to her and she read it and in like 2 days, and she came back and I was like so nervous. And she said, I was like, what'd you think? And she said that she was surprised that it was funny. She's like, I didn't think it'd be as funny as your other book. She's like, this is really funny. I was like, does it feel weird? She's like, yeah, it feels really weird, but I didn't hate it. I really didn't hate it. And then she asked if she could write something for the book, and I was, please, like, I mean, I had all these ideas. I thought I could let her annotate the book. Like, she could add footnotes through the whole thing, which would be awesome.
Oh, that would be interesting. Yeah, right.
So it was a long process and was not easy. Easy to write this book, very easy to write it because it was so necessary to process, but not easy to publish it. And I had a lot of long conversations with her, and we had conversations with our daughters, conversations with my agent and with my editor. And ultimately, what convinced us both to publish it was the encouragement of our friends. Lauren wrote a chapter, and she shared this with some of her friends who knew a little bit of our story. And they were like, Lauren, you guys have to tell this. Like, you have to tell this story. And we both agreed, like, it's going to be hard, but we'll do it. And it has been really hard. It's easier now. The book came out about 2 years ago, so it's not as hard these days. But publishing something like this is not for the faint of heart, for sure. Right. And I thought it would be easy. I'd already done it. I'd already published books about my family and, you know, spilling a few dark secrets about who we were. But this was a whole other thing.
Oh, yeah, there's a... This is the most painful suffering someone go through. It's actually praise God, fortunately, you didn't get a divorce, but divorce and everything that leads to it is worse trauma than your spouse dying. Because
yeah, it's brutal, man.
It is brutal. I it's a common thing for me, and I say this all the time, and so you obviously haven't heard it, so I'll tell you. I don't read the books before I have somebody on the podcast. I have the podcast and I go, don't want to read the book. So I'm not dissing you or any author who comes on. Just I have so many other things on my reading list. I just can't read all the books. But I go, now I've heard enough from you. Like, okay, I'm going to have to read your book. So this is real good. I got the rundown of it. I understand what it is. But this is really fascinating. And what I love about it, Harrison, without having read anything, you just telling me about it is, I'm a pastor by day. It's my day job. And I have had a lot of interaction with divorcing couples. I've had a lot of interaction with extramarital affairs. A lot. I've been through it a lot with folks. And the thing I always encourage people to do is, hey, at some point, you need to talk about this. At some point you need to, because this is very common and we understand we don't want to talk about it because we feel shame. We don't want to bear our garbage. It's going to put somebody else in a difficult light. Complications. Yes. And there's a lot of folks who just need a model of how to forgive, a model of how to process. And I'll go to some of those couples and say, hey, I got this other couple over here. Would you mind having a conversation with them? And they do, and every time it's helpful. So I applaud you and your wife for putting your hearts out there and writing a good book and trying to help people.
Thanks, man. Yeah, it's I tell people who, you know, when you publish a book like this, people start to sort of think that I'm a therapist or a counselor or something because I've written about it. And so I get I mean, I get DMs and messages and emails every week from strangers asking to talk and spilling their most horrid marital secrets to me over DMs, which was really heavy because I am not. I'm like, you really want to tell me this? Because I'm a writer, you know, so I might have to use this because you sound crazy right now.
Right.
But I do tell people when they ask for advice, I'm like, well, don't talk to me. I'm not a therapist and you don't know me. So don't tell me everything. But you do need to talk to a few people. I tell everybody, first of all, you need to talk to a friend. And if you don't have one of those, that's probably part of how you got in this situation. You got to have a friend. If you don't have friends, man, you are not doing like existence right. So you need to talk to a friend. You need to talk to your spouse. Even if you're separating, you have to leave those lines of communication open, because if you have kids, especially, you're going to be in this person's life and they're going to be in yours until forever. So you got to keep those lines open. You need to talk to a therapist slash pastor slash counselor, somebody in a position that has some professional knowledge that can help you. You need to talk to your God if you have one. If you don't, there are many out there to choose from, but you need to be talking to some transcendental being, and get out of your own head. I tell them about my God if they ask. You need to talk to, yourself. You need to look in the mirror and you need to look long and hard at who you are. But there are a lot of different types of people you need to talk to when the fit hits the shan, so to speak. You can't keep quiet.
So when you said, does anyone ever take you up on it and say, well, tell me about your God? What do you say when they ask you?
Well, I'm no evangelist, but I most people have heard of the Bible, and so there's a pretty good place to start with. I do talk about I write a lot about the Bible in this book. And there's a whole chapter where I literally just read the Bible from cover to cover, and I talk about it. And I do talk about the model of sacrificial love and the model of forgiveness that we learn from the story of Jesus, and how that gave me some tools to understand how to forgive myself for the things I had done to my wife and how to forgive my wife for the things she had done to me. And it was a really... The mercy that we read about in the New Testament was like water on parched lips, man.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't surprise me that is your background, because it's the framework for forgiveness that isn't as prevalent in other worldviews. It's just not. I mean, my worldview is that my marriage with my wife represents God's marriage with us. That's why Jesus called the bridegroom, and if you're in the church, you're called the bride of Christ. And I cheat on God all the time, and he forgives me. He doesn't break up with me. I cheat on him all the time. I do things he doesn't want me to do, and it offends him. It hurts him. And so that's what that I think that for me is the kind of impetus to consider forgiveness and for consider restoration is it's core to my spiritual identity anymore. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Forgiveness is something that we all know about, but it's not something that we have to do often. Maybe, you know, you forgive the guy who cut you off in traffic, or forgive your, you know, kids for, you know, taking $20 out of your wallet or something. Yeah. But real forgiveness for something that feels so brutally, sort of world destroyingly painful, is a whole other ball game. And that was what sort of made me dive back into the Bible. I mean, we were at a church when all this was happening, and I write a lot about that. There's so much about the church in this book, and for better and worse. There's a lot of bad things that happened in churches that I was in, and I write about that. But so I felt like I knew forgiveness probably better than your average American. I knew the concept. But really living through this, you really have to like, what does that really mean? It is one of the strangest concepts that exist in human thought, is this idea, right, of forgiveness. It's deep.
And when could you place your finger on when you actually forgave her, or was it a long meandering process, or just take us through that? If you don't mind, let's go back to like, how did you find out? What happened immediately? I know this is all in your book, but it'd be helpful for our podcast if you wouldn't mind.
Well, it's complicated. So the book starts in 2017. And when my wife told me that called me up one day and said, no, she didn't call me. She emailed me. It was on a Monday. And my life was pretty good at the time. A year before, I had published my first book 2 years before. The year before, I had won the Thurber Prize for American Humor, which is a really, really big deal. And yeah. It really sort of established me as a writer, sort of in the public consciousness. And I was getting invited to speak and perform at really cool events. I was writing for really cool magazines. Everything was kind of great. Hmm. That's always when terrible, terrible things happen.
Right.
And she texted me, emailed me one morning at work. It was in October. And she said, "Tonight, when the girls go to bed, can we talk?" And I was like, why is my wife emailing me? Like, what, she just texts me? It's so strange.
right.
And so that felt strange. You really got to listen to your gut in these moments. And my gut was like, something is very weird right now. And then I emailed her back like, sure, like we can talk, like about what? And her email response was bone chilling. It was one word, life. Mm. She wanted to talk about life. Mm. Which is very obviously like her way of saying like, it's too big to talk about right now. That's why we're going to talk tonight. So I immediately, right. Had an existential crisis on a Monday in October. So I live in beautiful Savannah, Georgia. My office is right on Forsyth Park, which is this amazing, big, huge, big green park. And it was a nice day. It's October. So I just walked around the park and I was like, what does life mean? Like, what is she talking about? And also, I'm going to have to wait like 8 hours before this conversation.
Ouch.
It was so painful. And I had came up with all these ideas, man. I was like, well, maybe it's bad. Okay. Maybe she wants to confess an addiction. Maybe she's secretly a pill addict, or maybe she's, an alcoholic and I just haven't noticed. Or maybe it's good, or maybe, I don't know, maybe she has cancer. That's not good. Right. Maybe, and she's kind of a hypochondriac, so that wouldn't have been odd. But maybe it's good. Maybe she just got some really cool, weird job offer, and we're going to have to move to Pakistan, or, just like something heavy. Right. And I could not figure out what it was. I was like, is it me? Is she going to confront me about something? Like, and I could not think of, I'm a complete jackwad, but
have I been taking enough showers? Do I smell? Is there something
right?
Wrong?
I just thought, what is it me? So anyway, it finally became night. I went home. It was definitely awkward at home. We had dinner, put the girls to bed. She's kind of cleaning up the kitchen. I'm kind of cleaning up the kitchen. I was just like, just come out with it. Like, what is going on? And we sat down in the living room. And she said, what I'm about to tell you is all me. It's not you. She didn't quite say it like that. That's a part of the conversation I don't recall exactly, but I remember she was basically saying like, this is not about you. And she was trying to say it in an encouraging way, which is never a good sign. I was like, oh wait, she's about to tell me something really awful. And she said, I want a divorce. And I like paused and thought about it. It's like, okay, that's okay. I said, why? That's all I said. I said, why? She said, I'm in love with someone else. I said, who? And she said the guy's name, who had been our neighbor for like 7 years up until recently. And that started, I didn't blow up. I don't typically blow up when I get really, really bad news or when, you know, things really turn south. I kind of get contemplative. I get curious. And I was like, okay, you want a divorce. You want a divorce. You want to marry this guy. Like, what? It's like, so before I decide how to feel, can you explain it to me? Can you just give me some, like, how did this happen? Like, just the same question that you're asking right now, Brian. Like, how did this happen? Like, I just wanted to know. I was doing my own little podcast interview in my living room on that night.
Yeah.
And it was like a criminal investigation. She was like, well, she kind of laid it out there. She was not emotionally, she was very kind of stoic. Mm-hmm. She had clearly made up her mind. This was the right thing to do. She wasn't mean or ugly. She didn't trivialize it. She was just very stoic. And I had a lot, I mean, like, and I get it now. At the time, she kind of felt cold, but I realized, like, this was really hard for her to do and to say.
Yeah, defense
and
mechanism.
So she was just, like, giving me the straight facts. And we talked for, like, 3 hours. Mostly, I paced, and she sat there. And I was like a, you know, Matlock on, you know, cross-examining the witness. I was like, well, what about this? Well, when did this? And there were some questions she couldn't answer or she didn't want to answer. The really emotional questions she didn't really get into, like, well, why him? Why, you know, what about him? Like, what is it? Is it me? I mean, you can imagine the 1,000 questions you would have. And I didn't know what to feel, what to think, but she kind of explained how they had, you know, it started with just a friendship and flirting, and then it just kind of snowballed over the years. And I was so into my career and always gone. Yeah, like I said, my book had just come out 2 years before that. So I had been on the road. I'd be on the road for a month. I'd come home for a few weeks. I'd be on the road again. Again, all part of my career and how I, like, and I remember that night when she was talking about all the times I was gone. And it wasn't a fight. It wasn't accusatory. She was just like, this is why I had an affair, because you seemed more interested in writing and seemed like you just wanted to move off to New York. And we seemed like an afterthought to you. And I remember, like, hitting the walls of the house, the walls of the living room. I was like, how do you think, like, we pay for these? You know, like, I'm working, like, and I know that's the greatest sin of so many husbands is overcommitment to work. And we can get into all that if you want to. That's a whole nother book. But I was like, I was doing it, like, I could have had so many affairs on the road and I didn't. Like, I wish I, you know, like, it was just this very emotional night. And about 3 hours later, she was like, well, we should go to bed. Like, we both have to work tomorrow. The girls have to get up early. Like, we can keep talking. And I was like, all right. So she went into a separate bedroom. She went into the guest bedroom. I went into the master and laid there and, you know, I felt lower than I'd ever felt in my life. And that's really how the book starts. And it's really a kind of murder mystery. Who killed my marriage?
Interesting.
Is it really dead?
Interesting. Yeah.
And so I become sort of I'm the private eye a little bit of this story. I'm trying to figure out, does she really want a divorce? Is she just crazy? Am I insane? Is she seeing something broken in our marriage that I haven't seen? Whose fault is this? Can it come back to life? And the story, I mean, takes off like a rocket ship and really doesn't stop for a span of about 4 years. There's a reconciliation. There's therapy. We get pregnant, which was wild because our youngest kid was like 10 years old. And so that was unusual. And the reconciliation followed by the pregnancy kind of felt like a good sign, you know, like, oh, okay, we're back.
Reconciliation following the pregnancy.
No. But no, the reconciliation happened pretty quick. And I don't want to spoil it for too many people.
I don't
want to read the book.
Yeah.
But there was, we do reconcile, and she breaks it off with this guy. And we both decide, all right, let's try to figure this out. And we're in therapy. It's okay. It's unsure. Our roles started to change in the marriage in a good way. So Lauren, that's my wife's name, she had always stayed home with the girls. It was always her dream to be a stay-at-home mom. She was her mom was a stay-at-home mom. She was homeschooled back in the 80s when that was a pretty rare thing still.
Yeah.
And Lauren really wanted that for our girls. And so I really had to double down on my career and on providing for the family. And that did create some what you see in a lot of couples, which is it just created some walls between us. I became the real expert at making money and doing things outside the home. She was the expert on what was happening inside the home. And so that really sort of drove a wedge between us over time. And I get into all this in the book and how that happened. And what I like, what's good about the book is that it's funny. Like, it's really entertaining and it's kind of absurd and I don't hold anything back. So we are then, I don't know, about a year into it, like things seem okay. And then the pandemic happened and everything just kind of turned upside down, like just like it did for a lot of people and a lot of families and careers and lives. Things really kind of went haywire. And but our marriage was different by then. I love to cook. I love to plan meals. I love to plan our meal chart. I had never done that before, but that was one thing I was doing. I was doing much more. I mean, I didn't have to be asked to wash the dishes. And I hate to have to admit that, but there was a time in our marriage where I just didn't even see them. They weren't even there.
Yeah.
Because in my, you know, like absolutely idiot gorilla male brain, she worked at home and that was part of the home and this is what she wanted to do, and I had 30 emails to respond to, so I'll do that and you do this. And it was such a kind of cold separation of responsibilities that really drove us apart. And like a lot of marriages, like we made those decisions for good reasons. But anyway, all that to say, by 2020, our marriage looked a little different in a good way, but things really went sideways. And that's about halfway through the book when things really, really catch on fire. And I won't say any more about that, but end of the book takes you all the way to 2021 when mostly we put the fire out. And I want to answer a question that you asked earlier, which is like, is there a moment of forgiveness?
Yes.
Or is it over time? And the short answer to that is definitely, I feel like you have to make so many conscious efforts to forgive continually. So it is a moment in time, but it's many moments in time. It's like a diet, right? Like, you know, you want to lose 20 pounds, you go on a diet. It's like saying, well, when was the moment when you lost the 20 pounds? Well, there is no moment when you lose 20 pounds. You'd go to the hospital if you did. It's just you're making decisions every day about working out, what you're going to eat, and you just keep making those decisions, and eventually you lose the weight. And that's sort of how it was with forgiveness.
But there was a moment when you do decide that I want to lose 20 pounds.
Yes.
What would you know that moment when you said, okay, I want to get to the path of forgiveness? Do you know when that was?
Yeah, I do. Well, I think I do. So it was the day after I got the bad news in 2017. And I just called Lauren's sister, who kind of knew what was going on. And I knew that her sister would be advocating for us to stay married and that she would be, you know, you hate the sort of combative nature of this situation because, you know, somebody has an affair, then there's somebody who's been cheated on, and so this person looks holy and good and you feel sorry for them, and this person looks evil and bad and you feel sorry for them in a whole different way. And that's such a dangerous position to be in, of the sort of you versus me, us versus them. But I did need allies. And I remember calling her sister and I was like, well, she told me, you know, do you want to come? Do you want to be here and just help? I don't know. Help with what? You know, I don't know. And Lauren had told a friend of hers, who was also a friend of mine, and I called her, she called me, basically just to say, like, what the heck? Like, what are we going to do? And this was just it's on a Tuesday around lunch. And I'm talking to her, and this scene is in the book. And I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. And she was like, I don't know what you're going to do either. Like, it was just kind of a nightmare. And she said, you know, like I'm thinking, well, do I just, do we go ahead and separate? Do we live in separate? Like we have these kids, like, do I need to move in with my mom? Do I call a lawyer? You have so many questions when all this goes down, much less the emotional questions of how do I feel about this? Do I want to stay married? Do I not? You're like everything. It is chaos. And this friend said, well, you're going to fight for her, aren't you? And it just like, it was like a lightning bolt, not of like, yeah, I'm going to fight for her. But it was more like, oh, I hadn't even thought of that. Like, because Lauren just seemed to be so sure that this was the right thing for us and that this is what she needed to do. And because I wasn't sure of anything, I was like, well, I guess Lauren is right. This is what we need to do. And when this friend said, you're going to fight for her, that really changed my thinking. And it made me realize like, okay, well, what does that look like? Does it look like crossing your arms and saying, I'm not getting a divorce, or I love you, or I forgive you? Like, what does that look like? And it took me, you know, 5 years to find out what that meant. And I'm still finding out what it means. I've got a friend right now, a lot of friends right now who are struggling in their marriage. And I often give them this advice of fight for your wife, fight for your marriage. But it looks so different for every person who's doing it, because sometimes it means safety. Sometimes it means protecting your spouse from somebody trying to hurt them, or protecting your children from your spouse, or protecting your children from being hurt. Sometimes fighting for your marriage may mean physical confrontation. Sometimes it may mean doing more laundry. I mean, it can mean a thousand different things.
Yeah. I did not personally read your book, but someone on my team read your book, and I love the line, I'll just quote, that they wrote down for me. If you want your marriage to survive, you need people in your life who believe in the idea of it. I love that. Talk more about that.
Well, you're going to get a lot of advice when your marriage blows up. And I'm not talking about, I mean, an affair would be sort of the extreme case, but marriages can blow up, as you know, in a thousand different ways. And when that happens, you're going to get a lot of advice, and you're going to get good, and you're going to get really bad advice. And if all the people in your life don't, if the people you're talking to, the friends that you have, if they don't really believe in marriage, meaning marriage being something worth fighting for. I mean, a lot of people are just, and it's not a surprise, but a lot of people are incredibly cynical about marriage because of their own broken marriages, because of their broken homes they grew up in, because they've had a series of just bad relationships. I'm talking about really nice, kind, funny, smart people who are entirely cynical about marriage. If those are the only people you have around you, you're going to get divorced, because they're all going to say, hey, man, it worked for me. Maybe it'll work for you. Or, you know, it's okay. It'll be really hard. But like, you know, screw him. I mean, there were so many people. Not so many, because I didn't like go tell 100 people that this was happening. But because you got to keep your sort of circle of trust pretty small when you're trying to navigate this in real time. But there were people that found out what was going on, and to a person, they were like, man, screw her. Like, you deserve better. Like, get out now. And these were people who loved me, who cared for me. But if those are the only people in your life, you're going to get divorced. You need people who say, hey, man, like, slow down. Fight for this. Like, I mean, even my pastor, who's one of my best friends and is the bass player in my band, and he's a cool dude, and I guess he's about 10 years younger than me too. He said, he was so wise through this. He wasn't my pastor in 2017, but he was in 2021. Jesus says you can get divorced, so you totally can if you want. Your wife had an affair, dude. Like, you can do that. He goes, what does it look like for that not to be the first thing you try? What does it look like for you to fight for your marriage? What does it look like for you to think about your marriage from your wife's perspective? Just slow down. You've got to have people like that. If you want to save your marriage, you got to find somebody who believes in it. Maybe that's a therapist. Maybe it's a pastor. Maybe it's just a friend. I have found that talking to divorced people is really can be really helpful too.
Yeah.
Like, not all divorced people are cynics. They've lived through absolute hell. And so you got to find good people to talk to, though.
It is true that it's another sign of the difficult culture in which we live, which you talked about earlier. Relationships, people are pouring their heart out to you on DM because they really don't have any other options. They don't have friends, and many of us who do have friends don't have friends who know how to say the right thing at the right time. You know, none of us want to be rejected. None of us do. So all of us want to support our friend. So it's very natural in those situations. Well, screw her. Yeah, you're going to find better than her. Heck yeah, you are. She's going to rue the day. Just reject, because that's what we feel like. I need to reject you before you reject me. You've already rejected me with this hurt. Now I need to hyper reject you and, you know, cut the whole thing off. That's just the normal thing. I had a friend of mine, this is a while ago. He called me. He was having some issues with his marriage. And he said, hey, my wife just said she was leaving. For the purpose of this story, I'll call her Susan, even though her real name is Becky. But he said, Susan, it's neither of those names, in case you're wondering. He said, hey, Susan said she's leaving me, so I'm getting my stuff. I'm moving out. And I said, what? Wait, no, you don't. No, she can't just tell you that she's leaving. No, she can't tell you just moving out. You go back in there, tell her that you don't accept that the marriage is over and you're not leaving and that you're up for working this out, figuring out what it is, but you're not leaving. You want to fight for the marriage. And he called me back a few hours later and said, well, said, if I had you as a friend for my first marriage, I'd still be married to that woman. Because all my friends said, oh, screw her, you're going to get better, all that sort of stuff. And so, and I'm so satisfied that he is still together with her in a great marriage, gosh, 5-10 years later. It's good stuff.
Well, you feel really, you forget when something like this happens to you, you forget that you have agency. It sort of feels like, well, if you're in a partnership with your spouse, and so if they decide it's over, then it's kind of over, right? Because it takes both of you. And that's sort of what the marriage certificate is there for. That's why you can't just wave a wand and get a divorce. And so it was remembering that I had agency. I was like, oh, wait, like I knew this. I talk about this in the book too. Lauren really thought, I think she thought I was just going to pack a bag and head out that night. Like, screw you, I'm done. And I think she thought that I wanted to get a divorce, that I'd be kind of happy, that I'd be pissed, but that I'd be happy. I mean, I had so many friends here in town. My mom lives right up the street. I had plenty of places I could have gone to, but I was like, wait, no, I'm not going. It's my house. I pay for this house. I'm not leaving this house. I mean, I wasn't going to kick her out because I felt like she would just go right to this guy. But I remember thinking like, oh, I have a say in this too. I'm obviously like, you know, it's a free country. I can't keep my wife prisoner in my home. I mean, she can leave if she wants to. But I told her, I was like, this is my house and I'm staying. And that, you know, like I wasn't a jerk about it. I wasn't a threat. It was like, this is my home. My kids are here. My wife is here. Why would I leave? I'm not leaving. Yeah. I think that definitely surprised her. I think it was a little bit.
Maybe you can leave if you want, but no.
Right. I said leaving. That. I was like, you can leave if you want. I can't make you stay. I was like, but I'm not leaving. I love this house. I love this family. I'm definitely staying. And that's another bit of advice, not that you asked, but it's so easy to make the situation worse when you get bad news like this through anger, saying things that you really don't mean, trying to hurt them, kicking them out, throwing all their stuff in the yard. Don't do that. If you have any shred of hope for your marriage, don't make it worse. It's already really bad.
Yeah. Yeah. You're, it's not even if you don't have any hope for your marriage, you're never going to look back on that and say, yeah, and then I threw her stuff out in the lawn and that really showed her and that was the right thing to do. You're not going to feel like that was the right thing to do 10 years from now.
One bit of advice, but just insight that I've shared with others and it was shared with me is, okay, your marriage is maybe over. Maybe it definitely is over. But if you don't fight for it, don't you think you'll regret that in 5 years or 10 years that you at least tried? Shouldn't you try to do something and save this thing just so that you can say you tried? Like, I've got a buddy who just got divorced, a really close friend. And man, that dude tried. He really tried. And she did too. They really both tried to save the marriage. And those of us observing what was happening and talking to them, we saw that they were earnestly trying. And it just didn't work. And he doesn't have to hang his head. Like, they got a divorce, but man, they tried. And they earnestly tried for several years. And so he doesn't carry any what ifs now.
Yeah.
Because he did try. And I tell anybody, like, look, dude, you hate her, she hates you. Looks like you're on a road to divorce, but give it one last shot, man. So you don't wake up on your deathbed and go, man, I wish I would have tried harder. Like, just try.
I love this line. Compatibility is an accomplishment of marriage, not a prerequisite. Give that sermon for me.
Well, first I'll say that's not my line. That was, I quote Alan de Botton in the book, who is one of my favorite nonfiction writers. He's really awesome. Elaine, A-L-A-I-N. And that what that line is, compatibility is an achievement of marriage, I believe is the quote, not a prerequisite. That gets to the heart of this sort of lie inside the idea of soulmates.
Right.
And if you have a hyper-romantic view of relationships, then that's going to do some harm in your life. Because as soon as things don't work out with your boyfriend, girlfriend, wife, husband, whatever, you think you're soulmates, and then you start not to like each other very much, which is what happens in any human relationship. Then you're like, oh, well, we're not soulmates. It was the wrong match. So we have to get a divorce or break up and I'll find my right soulmate. Strangely enough, soulmates often appear to you when you're in a rough patch in your actual relationship. So your soulmate, right. your crush.
Amazing how they just pop up, right? Wow.
It's amazing how your soulmate can just appear when you're really mad at your husband or wife. And this idea that there are things about people that are naturally compatible. I've got one of our friends who lives up the street. She and my wife are like best friends, and she's awesome. But my wife is not really a book person. She doesn't read a lot. She does read probably more than the average person, but I'm kind of obsessed with books. Well, this friend loves books. And when this friend is at our house, she and I talk about books and writing and stories continually. So clearly we are compatible when it comes to that topic, right? And I think people think that all compatibility must be organic like that, meaning there are a lot of things that I do not have in common with my wife. She doesn't really like my kind of music. She doesn't really, we do like the same TV shows, but we don't really like the same music or books. She loves hot dogs. She'll eat a dozen hot dogs right now. If I paid her money to, she'd go eat 12 hot dogs right now. I hate hot dogs. And I think people get this idea that, oh, you find all these ways that you're incompatible with your spouse. And you're like, this is evidence that we shouldn't be together. Because look, we can't talk about books. We can't talk about movies. We can't go to the same hot dog restaurant. Do they even have hot dog restaurants? I don't even know what that is. And you forget that those are important, but they're surface, like minor points of compatibility. are like, I, you know, if you've got a buddy and you and he both love the Alien movies, like, great, you're compatible, you can hang out and be friends. But for a marriage to work, the compatibility has to be far more than surface level. And I always tell people, you're going to marry the wrong person. You're going to marry the wrong person because every person is the wrong person because you are an absolute train wreck. And there's about 20 different versions of you that your spouse will see over 20 years of marriage. So you don't know who you are. You don't know who they are. They don't know who they are. They don't know who you are. And so what you're doing is you're trying to sort of learn how to let go of some things and achieve compatibility, not come in with it as a factory setting. And the way you do that is through love and forgiveness and doing life together. And like, I don't do the dishes because my wife is going to have an affair if I don't do the dishes. I do the dishes because my wife loves a clean sink. I don't really care, Brian. I don't care if the sink's clean or not. But my wife loves when the sink is empty and clean. And I will do the dishes because I want her to be happy. I want her to see that and go, oh, this is awesome. Just like she buys me things at the grocery store that she doesn't think we need and thinks are too expensive. I mean, it's just learning compatibility, learning like what she likes and doesn't like.
So yeah, that's fantastic.
It's not there. There are no soulmates other than the one you create in your marriage over time.
Yes. The book is called How to Stay Married, The Most Insane Love Story Ever Told. One last question I have for you, and then if you got anything you want to talk about that I haven't fed you a line for, then great, let's get on it. But right now, is there an aggressive move you're making for your marriage now that you weren't making pre-2017?
A lot more naked dancing in my bedroom, which is another way of saying flirting.
Naked, like you alone, just trying to turn her on, or like you're holding each other naked?
Oh, dancing? Like just me. Like I come out of the shower and I just, I'm performing with a towel. It's the world's most hideous burlesque show.
And she likes that.
I make her like it. We're just very different people. And she kind of rolls her eyes and she's like, why are you the way you are? You know, but I have found that, I'm really getting into flirting with my wife aggressively. And what I mean by that is, a funny remark, a flirty remark, she went to the liquor store a couple days ago and she came in with a couple bottles of wine and a bottle of tequila. And I was like, I just said, you know, if you're planning on taking advantage of me later, I'm in agreement with your plan. You know, just like just finding ways to express affection that's not really sexual. Like obviously if she's stripping down and you're stripping down, then you want sex. One or both of you want sex. That's not really flirting at that point. You're just doing it. But finding a way to flirt that doesn't end in sex, maybe just ends with a kiss, ends with a hug, a playful, smack on the rear end. I smacked her the other day, while she was, washing dishes. And she hates that. She really hates that, Brian. And I shouldn't have done it. And she was like, it's not. And then she was like, I'm going to get you when you're washing dishes and you can't defend yourself. So I start washing the dishes immediately. And like, please, like hit me.
How would you do that? Yes. Explain that to me, please.
Like, yeah. Like, I'm like, oh, please don't throw me in that briar patch. So just finding ways to playfully flirt. Obviously, it's different for every couple. But just I'm leaning into that these days and finding that it makes me like my marriage a lot more, and it makes me excited to see my wife a lot more. Because if I do it in the right way, she starts flirting back, and I'm I will sort of step back and look at us and think, man, 5-10 years ago, this marriage would have been unrecognizable to me. To be able to playfully flirt and laugh and I was being really defensive the other day and she pointed it out. And, you know, 5 years ago, I would have pouted. I just would have pouted the rest of the day. But I just got over it. Like, life's too short to pout. You know, I was like, you're right. I was being defensive, whatever. Your breath smells, we're even, you know, like just finding ways to sort of let things go. Like, that's forgiveness, right? Just like, don't hold on to all this, even the small stuff, the small slights, like get it out, like communicate. Don't, like, those small slights build up over time into real tragedy for a marriage. Really small stuff.
Harrison, is there anything you wanted to talk about that I haven't asked you about or you haven't had a chance to say yet?
No, man, you have great questions and always happy to talk to new listeners and to meet you. I got nothing else to add.
Well, I'm really intrigued. I'm looking forward to getting this book more. Well, it is a compelling story and it's an encouraging one, and I appreciate that. And I'll give my normal call out to everybody. I like to do at the end, hey, I hope for a lot of us, you never have to apply anything to this because you never are on the verge of divorce, or you never have an affair, or you're never married to somebody who has an affair. But all of us could do a little bit better on forgiving. All of us could do a little bit better of putting ourselves in the shoes of somebody else, operating with empathy. And I hope that that is an aggressive move you're going to make, because it's not a move that's going to happen in your natural self. And it's not even a move that's going to be applauded inside of our culture. Make that move and get to the next place. Harrison, any place you want to point people towards? Any websites or any advertisements you want to do for yourself?
Well, you can find me on Instagram. That's where I'm most active, at Harrison Scott Key. I'm on X as Harrison Key. And the website's just my full name. You can just Google me if you want to find out how to get in touch with me, Harrison Scott Key. I'm so far, I'm the only one out there.
You and your brother Francis.
Old Francis, yeah.
Hey, man, thanks for your time. This is great. And we'll see you all next time on The Aggressive Life. Thanks for joining us on this journey toward aggressive living. Find more resources, articles, past episodes, and more at briantome.com. My new book, a 60-day devotional called The 5 Marks of a Man, 60 Days to a Powerful Life, along with all the other books in the 5 Marks library, are open right now on Amazon. Be sure to leave us a rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. Then send an email to dirt@briantome.com to get a free Aggressive Life sticker. Find more on Instagram at Brian Tome. The Aggressive Life is a production of Crossroads Church, Cincinnati, Ohio.